This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL, Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, what American women have to say about abortion. Researchers Andrea Press and Elizabeth Cole spent 4 years watching television with a cross-section of women. They watched programs in which abortion played a role, then discussed the shows with the women to gain a better understanding of their views on abortion. Questions and comments for our guests are welcome. You can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, so if you're outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Guests Andrea Press and Elizabeth Cole are the authors of Speaking of Abortion, Television and Authority in the Lives of Women. Andrea Press is Associate Professor of Communication and Women's Studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, where she also directs the Media Studies Program. She is here in the studio with me this afternoon. Joining us by telephone, Elizabeth Cole. She is Assistant Professor of Psychology and African American Studies at Northeastern University. Speaking of abortion, their book is published by the University of Chicago Press. Again, our telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free. Anywhere else you're listening, 1-800-222-WILL. Andrea Press, Elizabeth Cole, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Hi.
Hi. When you let me back up here a minute. You found that when women talk about abortion, they acknowledge, I'm quoting here from the book, they acknowledge sources of power and social control and locate themselves in relation to power in different ways. I think this is an interesting idea to think about, and I think it's a good point to begin. Talk about that idea with us, and was that your thesis at the outset?
No, that wasn't our thesis. Actually, we weren't sure what we would find when we set out to speak with women about abortion. We were looking to look at the way women speak about a social, political, and moral issue. Very little research has actually been done specifically with women about political issues, and we thought that abortion was a good issue to look at women's political discourse on because it spans so many categories in the political literature. It's a private issue. It's a public issue. It's in the news. People have a lot of experience with it. So we chose abortion for that reason. And the way we looked at abortion is we went into women's homes in what we call a semi-public setting to look at a location where women might speak about public issues that was somewhat private but also somewhat public, because in their homes women may talk to their friends, to people outside their families. And that's the kind of situation we strove to replicate.
Mm. And also in the home is coming in media.
Right.
And so that also is another public-private kind of thing that's happening there.
Sure. We looked at media because we were looking for a repository of our culture's rhetoric about abortion. So getting back to your question, when we're looking at issues of power, we found that issues of power and social class really rent media discourse about abortion. They permeated television treatments of abortion. And they also permeated the way women spoke about abortion. Liz, do you want to add to that?
Well, what I think we hadn't anticipated when we began collecting the data is that when women experience the abortion issue in their lives, often they're coming in contact with different societal agents of power and authority. So whether when they're seeking an abortion, they're dealing with doctors. When women encounter political activism around abortion, often there are police there. It's a legal issue. Lawyers are involved. And these are themes that came up again and again in the entertainment television treatments of abortion, and that we found the women in the conversations we had with them were dealing with. As they dealt with abortion, they also were coming into contact with how these authorities structure women's access to abortion. And we found that far from just seeing it as a private issue, women were also talking about these cultural and political and social agents of power and their attitudes towards them.
Hmm. What television programs did you use?
We used an episode of Cagney and Lacey. We used a clip from a made-for-TV movie called Roe vs. Wade, which dramatized the real-life story of Jane Roe fighting the illegality of abortion in Texas. And we used an episode of Dallas. We chose these shows because they actually illustrate a range of rhetorical strategies that television uses to present the abortion issue. What we found that was common among almost all the primetime television shows that we looked at in order to try to select a limited number of shows to use is that abortion is a classed issue on primetime television. Only poor or working class women are shown seeking abortion legitimately on television. Middle class, upper middle class, wealthy people cannot seek abortion legitimately on primetime television now. And so in that sense, when you see depictions of abortion on television, you also see depictions of poor and working class people for the most part. Middle class women like Murphy Brown, who found herself with a surprise pregnancy, pretty much decide not to seek abortions. Even though, you know, in real life, someone like Murphy Brown might be likely to get an abortion on television, she becomes a single mother and has her child.
Or sometimes they're shown to miscarry or be mistaken and they're not really pregnant at all.
In our episode of Dallas, an upper middle class slash wealthy woman, Donna, in a minor scion of the Ewing family, finds herself pregnant and also finds that she's carrying a child with Down syndrome. Now, in reality, the vast majority of women in that position do seek abortions. Donna decided to have the baby, but in a typical rhetorical strategy of primetime television, she was spared the consequences of that decision because fortuitously she was kicked in the stomach by a bull at a rodeo, causing her to miscarriage. But this actually often happens to middle-class women on television who find themselves with unwanted pregnancies, not the rodeo part, but the miscarriage plot.
Now, the women that you interviewed, what was their view of how television presents abortion, tackles the issue? I mean, did anyone say, isn't it interesting that the only people in entertainment programming on television who are having abortions are economically strapped?
Well, actually, we found that middle-class women were the least likely to be critical of this particular aspect of television's portrayal of abortion.
Middle-class pro-choice women.
Right, middle-class pro-choice women. The pro-life women were less divided around class lines. Pro-life women and working-class pro-choice women did tend to notice the classed rhetoric of abortion and to comment on it quite explicitly. One pro-life woman actually said something like, you know, they always put these poor women in these shows. Why don't they put someone like you, Dr. Press? You know, you have a good job.
What does that say about the quality of the public discourse on this topic? That it is somewhat quite limited, isn't it?
Well, I think one of the main points we make in the book is that class is a hidden discourse in the abortion debate and has not been brought out very much as social class. And that we need to talk about what that means, especially in terms of the pro-choice movement. I think we need to talk about how specifically political pro-choice rhetoric might have alienated working-class participants in that movement, and how class biases in abortion discourse are sort of hidden and swept under the table and not made explicit. But working-class pro-choice people are seeing them. Pro-life people are seeing them. They just haven't been brought to the forefront of the abortion debate. Do you want to add to that, Liz?
Well, I think you can really clarify the way that working-class pro-choice women might feel that the movement isn't speaking to them by talking about the way that that group perceived the class nature of these television treatments of abortion, because those women, working-class women who were pro-choice, were also critical, but in a different way than the pro-life women. They felt that these depictions of poor and working-class women seeking abortion had an underlying subtext in which seeking abortion was okay or even admirable from a poor woman, and they rejected that depiction of poor working-class women as being helpless, as not having options. They felt that it is possible to raise children on low income and were sort of skeptical that the subtext of these television treatments was that women like them shouldn't be having kids. And I think that that's a way that they were sort of suspect of the pro-choice movement in general, even though they did support abortion rights.
Mm. Yeah, and a lot of the pro-choice working class women we talked to, they just basically wanted to keep abortion out of the courts, in part because some of them feared they would be forced to have abortions. Their pro-choice perspective was based on a fear of the legal system for mistreating them, for treating them unfairly, and they didn't want any part of subjecting their own mm-hmm. reproductive capacities to the legal system.
So many children out of wedlock, and you can no longer
exactly
collect payments for those children.
Exactly.
How many women did you talk to?
Just around 100.
And how did
give
you
or take?
How did you select the participants?
For the most part, we placed ads in local newspapers. We collected this data when we were both still at the University of Michigan. And when a woman would answer our ad, we would ask her if she was willing to host a group of her friends or family in her home. And the good thing about this strategy is that you might expect that people who would answer the ad would be the women who were most interested in abortion, but since we had each of those initial respondents invite their friends, we hope that broadened the sample to include the kind of women who might not have answered the ads themselves.
Yeah. Now, in a setting like this, you have a free-flowing discussion, right? Kind of, I mean, you're guiding with interview questions and whatnot, but was there any concern that the group dynamic could shape the views expressed?
Well, I think in some ways that was something that we hoped for because mm-hmm. in a one-on-one interview, the interviewer might have a lot more control over the topics that are discussed. But our goal in using a group was to let the group itself shape the discussion a little more, to have people responding to each other's views instead of just looking to the interviewer as sort of the authority and the guide.
Yeah.
I think a lot of public opinion research does focus on individuals. You get a survey, you answer that survey alone, you answer a telephone survey by yourself. But actually, public opinion is something that's collectively formed that people have in the context of a group. So we didn't feel that the group context mm-hmm. biased our data.
Were any of these women activists at all? in the debate over abortion?
Well, we were explicitly interested in studying women who are not activists because when we started this project, there were already two well-known books that were based on interviews with activists. So we were explicitly trying to understand non-activist women's opinions because we thought that's more representative of the majority of American women in general. We did interview some pro-life women who had a little bit of involvement in pregnancy counseling centers, which you could argue is activist, but they were more involved in the issue in a one-on-one kind of setting than picketing clinics or things like that. And we did do one group with a group of pro-choice activists, but we really, their views were not very much included in our book. We sort of included them for contrast for our own information.
Yeah, and actually it was interesting to have the activist group because their version of pro-choice was much less complex and much less contradictory in a lot of ways. They had a very straight take on pro-choice. Abortion is always okay, morally, ethically, politically.
And one would suspect that pro-life activists would be
the same.
Well,
we did do a group of pro-life activists.
There'd be a high contrast. There'd be one, you know,
yeah.
Clear cut.
Yeah. I mean, partly we were drawn to non-activist women. It's true that there were well-known books already sampling activist women. But I thought non-activist women would have more interesting perspectives on abortion because they would be complex and contradictory, and I think that is what we found.
Yeah. Now, the women that you talk to, they would label themselves pro-life or pro-choice, but within those labels, this is very interesting, a lot of gray area.
Right.
Talk with us, if you would, about women who might call themselves pro-choice but might oppose late-term abortion or abortion as birth control. Or are there other ambivalencies at work?
Well, one of the main findings of the book is that the labels pro-life and pro-choice are actually umbrella terms that encompass a wide range of positions on the issue. We use them in this country as though they indicate uniform opinion groups, but in our study, we actually found that they don't. And we gave everybody a questionnaire to fill out at the beginning of the interview, and we sat and watched while they filled out the questionnaire. And one of the questions on it was an abortion opinion question taken from a national survey. One of the surveys that's often used to give out information to journalists about X percentage of the American population is pro-choice or pro-life. We found many, many women getting to that question and asking us about it. Do I have to pick one box? This really doesn't describe my opinion. Can I write something in here, a qualification? Which we thought was really interesting and indicative of the inadequacy of these labels to describe the shadings. And yes, pro-life women and pro-choice women, everyone self-identifies. Everyone in our country can pretty much pick a label. Am I pro-choice? Mm-hmm. Am I pro-life? That doesn't mean that everyone's opinion is the same on abortion.
Again, you know, someone who might call themselves pro-life would not oppose abortion in a case of rape or incest or
exactly some
when
women
a woman's
didn't.
Life is endangered.
Right.
The way women spoke about abortion, did it mirror the public language, the public dialogue on abortion? Elizabeth, you want to take that one?
Well, I think that what's interesting about our book is the ways in which their discussions of abortion raised issues that were much more complex than the national debate. So, for example, Andrea and I both went into our interviews with the pro-life women expecting that their arguments about abortion were largely going to be focused around religious arguments, because that was our perception of the public discourse. And what we were really surprised to find is that many of the pro-life women we spoke to talked about it in terms of science and medicine, and they felt that the real facts about fetal development and women's biology would reveal that abortion is wrong and that it's hurtful to women, and that what women needed to know were the true facts, the true medical facts about abortion that were being hidden from them by the medical establishment, which they perceived as being pro-choice. So it's very interesting to us that the pro-life discourse was so pervaded with these arguments that were couched in terms of science and technology, much more than the pro-choice groups were, because it was a very different kind of discourse than we had expected. So I think what's most interesting about our book is the ways in which that these women talked about abortion in ways that were really different from the public discourse.
Yeah.
You know, and I think in that vein also, talking to middle-class pro-choice women, we found the most common opinion expressed in this group was something that went sort of like, I think abortion should be legal, but I could never have an abortion for myself. Which I have not, you know, I mean, it does mirror the rhetoric of most of our political candidates who are advised by their pollsters to take this perspective. But this study gave us an opportunity to kind of probe this opinion and to probe maybe in some ways the complexities of liberal thought. How does someone justify such a strong conviction that abortion would be a wrong decision for her, but also an equally strong conviction that it should not be illegal, that no one can make this kind of decision for somebody else. That we found really interesting. And it partly does appear in public debates about abortion, but I think people don't probe it very, very hard.
Yeah. How do you feel about the labels pro-life and pro-choice? Would we be better served by a label of anti-abortion and supports abortion rights?
Liz, do you want to comment?
Well, I feel like I can answer that question based on my own political views, but we felt as ethnographers that we should use the terms that the women themselves felt comfortable labeling themselves with. So politically, I am pro-choice, and so I perceive many people who are pro-life as being anti-choice, but I guess in my role as a researcher, I don't think it's appropriate to label people with a label they don't accept for themselves.
Mm. I mean, I also am pro-choice, and I think that how I feel personally about the labels, I think they're both probably a little inadequate. Pro-choice doesn't sort of, it isn't very descriptive as a label, and I think pro-life, from my perspective, has a little more of a positive connotation than pro-choice does, and I think that's not serving the debate very well.
Hmm. How did you deal with the issue of your own views as you got further and further into this study?
Liz, do you want to talk? Do you want? we're actually writing a paper on that right now that goes a little deeper into that than we did in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's an important question, especially given the way ethnography in the academy is developing now. Ethnography as an enterprise, qualitative research in general. I think our opinions were a little bit of a problem in this study because as ethnographers, we wanted to be able to take the perspective of the women we were speaking to, yet both of us were very strongly pro-choice in our own personal opinions. Probably I had a position that was very similar to the pro-choice activists where I did not think abortion was at all wrong. And I was speaking to many women, almost everyone in the study disagreed with me on that. Once you got beyond the pro-choice activists, you had sort of a range of condemnation of abortion as a practice. And I felt very strongly that I shouldn't misrepresent myself or hide myself. I actually did most of the talking in the interviews. Mm-hmm. Liz was there at every interview, but I pretty much ran them. So I was actually dreading the moment when a pro-life woman would confront me and say, "And how do you feel about abortion?" And that moment never came in the entire study. We planned for it. We talked mm-hmm. about it. We argued. It never came, and we're not sure why it didn't come. We have a few hypotheses about that. One is that since we were both university researchers, perhaps pro-life women just did assume that we were pro-choice, and part of their motivation for agreeing to be interviewed might have been that they wanted to present their perspective to us.
They wanted you to have the facts.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. You know, I mean, it's really pretty telling that that moment didn't come, because I think to this day I still don't exactly know what I would have said, because in some cases I might have been afraid for my personal safety, too, and that might have forced me to lie. I really don't know. But in writing the book and interpreting the data, we felt that it was very important to take the perspective of the people we were talking to, that in some ways it's a violation of what ethnography is about not to make a really strong attempt to do that and to represent people's views as they feel them and see them. And I also felt much less alienated in the pro-life interviews than I had anticipated being. In most of them, I was able to feel somewhat in sympathy with the women, even though, you know, if it came down to it, I did disagree with them about abortion. But a lot of the arguments they present to support a pro-life perspective, one could view sympathetically even while disagreeing on this particular issue. I mean, I think abortion is such a complex issue that pro-life women see it in terms of a series of arguments that are not at all the same sort of arguments pro-choice people are thinking about when they're thinking about abortion. You know, I'm as a pro-choice woman, I'm thinking about women's need for reproductive independence and a patriarchal society that often denies women this need. And I'm also thinking of a scientific set of what I see as facts that don't determine when life begins, that can't determine when life begins. And pro-life women are seeing an entirely different array of facts here and issues.
But I was struck that many of the pro-life women did see their pro-life position as being rooted in a concern for women, and that they felt that abortion yeah. was abusive of women, and that many women were making decisions about abortion at a time when they were vulnerable and they weren't given access to the information they needed. And even though I didn't agree with the pro-life women, I came to understand that many of them were really concerned about women's well-being and had a different assessment of what would help ensure that well-being than I did. But I felt like we did have certain values in common that I didn't know before we did these interviews.
Hmm, interesting. We're talking this afternoon with Elizabeth Cole. She's with us this afternoon by telephone. She's assistant professor of psychology and African American studies at Northeastern University. And here
she's associate now.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Associate professor. And here with me in the studio, Andrea Press. She is Associate Professor of Communication and Women's Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where she also directs the Media Studies Program. Together, Press and Cole are the authors of Speaking of Abortion, Television and Authority in the Lives of Women. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, your questions are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. WILL, and in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. I want to talk about the pro-life women and the connection. Well, I think that often it's thought that there is no connection between science and scripture for the pro-life camp, but you found that not to be true at all. It was very interesting. Andrea, you want to talk about that?
Yeah. We found that for the pro-life women we spoke with, there was a strong belief that science would actually support scripture, bolster it. And doing research on this issue, we found that, of course, there's a long tradition in American fundamentalism, certainly, of believing this and researching it, that scientific data is actually going to support what's in the Bible. And so a lot of pro-life comments were trying to illustrate this for us, to illustrate through a reliance on science and medical data that abortion is bad for women, that abortion is murder, that abortion is wrong. So there wasn't as much emotionally sort of blind kinds of arguments made as perhaps we might have expected on an issue like abortion. There was a lot of stories that women claimed were drawn from medical literature that they knew of about women having abortions that say mysterious ailments were cured when a woman did not take her doctor's advice to have an abortion but decided to go ahead with a problematic pregnancy. The baby would be okay. The woman's medical problems would be cleared up. And stories of the disasters that might befall women who had abortions, stories of how women's mental health might deteriorate, their physical health might deteriorate. And with this came a lot of information about how pro-life women felt about doctors and medicine and other sources of mainstream authority and information in our culture. Women felt it very important to select their own doctors. They were very mistrustful of most doctors and gave us examples of how biased doctors were against the fetus, non-pro-life doctors that they had seen. Some doctors would laugh off a miscarriage and treat life irreverently in their, according to their perspective. Do you want to add to that, Liz?
No, I think you were very complete.
Okay. Let's talk with a caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. I consider myself, I guess, mostly pro-choice, but I think maybe the woman should make the choice before she gets pregnant whether to either not have sex or use a condom or something rather than using it as a means of birth control later. I guess that's mostly my opinion. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your call this afternoon. I think that's another example of how the issue is very complex.
Well, yeah. Although another thing that was surprising to me in doing these interviews is how many pro-life women shared that perspective. So I had expected the pro-life women to be fairly anti-birth control, but I don't think we spoke to a single pro-life woman who was against birth control, did we, Andrea?
Yeah, I can't remember that either. A lot of women, pro-choice women too, connected the use of birth control to abortion decisions. For example, we'd have a lot of pro-choice women who would say, now, if a woman doesn't use birth control and has multiple abortions, well, that's wrong. That's a misuse of abortion. But if a woman uses birth control all the time and maybe one time it fails, that might be, although that's a difficult decision, that might be a legitimate abortion decision. So birth control is a very related issue to abortion for people on both sides of the debate.
Well, it was also striking to me how many women we interviewed had personal stories of birth control failing.
Yeah, so, to me
in
too.
In the public discourse, we talk about birth control as though it's almost foolproof, but that doesn't seem to be at all the case in actual women's lives.
This might be a good point to talk about the issues of privacy and of public good or of the larger group. Because here we've got, I think this is what this issue is touching on the birth control issue. What's legitimate and what's, when does it become not a good thing? What did women, what can you tell us about what you learned about those issues as a result of talking with these women?
Well, in fact, in the working class pro-choice group, we talk about two types of opinions. One we call working class identified, which we've probably discussed a little bit already. The other we called middle class identified, and these were women who were actually very concerned about the way abortion was a drain on public resources. So these were women who said, look, it's your personal responsibility to use birth control, to avoid abortions, because why should taxpayers' money be paying doctors in a clinic to abort you if you're going to be that irresponsible? And once you make one mistake or two mistakes, after that, no one should be allowed to get an abortion. I think people were very clued in to sort of the public dimensions of the abortion issue in that sense. The drain on public resources, the misuse of doctors' time. But maybe you're asking a question
that's
a little bit different.
That's an interesting facet of it. Also, what about the idea of what is moral?
Mm-hmm. And which part of morality might be private and which part?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you want to speak to that?
Well, I think one thing that we saw by spending, two or three hours talking with these women is that it was a very complicated one for almost everyone we talked to, because they weren't only talking about it as a public issue. They were also talking about it in relation to decisions that they themselves had made or that their friends had made. And often we heard women talk about sort of a generality, oh, maybe it's wrong to have two or three abortions. But then they would counter it with, but I had a friend who, and in the context of some particular woman's life, often women felt that sort of moral absolutes didn't apply, because they could see in those particular situations contingencies that might make it right in that particular context. And I think that was true for pro-life women and or for pro-choice women, as you might expect, but also sometimes for pro-life women. So we actually ran one group where we showed them the Roe versus Wade movie, which depicts the Jane Roe fictional character as being in a terrible situation. She's already given an earlier child to her mother to raise. She finds herself pregnant again. She's unemployed. The father is gone. She can't raise this child because she can't even raise the child she's already had. She's in a really desperate position, and we interviewed one pro-life group where someone in that group actually said that she was against abortion, but maybe in this case it was the right thing because that woman's plight as an individual spoke to her so much. So when you're dealing with women's opinions who aren't politicians, aren't policymakers, I think they're very attuned to the desperation that women sometimes face, and they see that moral absolutes don't always apply in those situations.
Yeah. The women that you talked to, did you ask in your questionnaire if anyone had had an abortion or considered one, and had that been had an impact on their views on abortion?
Actually, we didn't ask that in the questionnaire because I think we felt that that was the kind of question we wanted women to speak to in the group. We didn't just want to get a questionnaire answer on that. We might have felt it was a little intrusive to ask. Obviously, women were coming to a discussion about abortion. They were concerned about the issue. They took it seriously, and we wanted to give it that kind of consideration instead of, did you have an abortion? Yes, no.
I would imagine, though, that would temper your views on abortion if you had actually put yourself into, you know, if you were in that position, if you had had an abortion, or if there had been a circumstance, you know, if there had been a point in your life where you considered it.
Well, it was interesting because many women did tell stories about that in the interviews, and one of the things that was sort of striking to us was how many women who had actually had made that decision at another point in their lives now felt that it was out of the question, either because they were now married or because they had had children since then that had changed their mind about what pregnancy really meant. And I would have to say the only group of women who consistently did not take that kind of distance from abortion to say it was something I did then but could never do now was the working class pro-choice women.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because their economic situation always let them know that they could be in a situation where that would be the right choice for them.
But see, I was also struck by the way middle-class pro-choice women spoke about that as well. We had women on all sides, pro-life women, pro-choice women, who had had abortions. And I think having an abortion does not affect your opinion about it in any predictable way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think pro-life women had had abortions. Pro-choice women had had abortions. Pro-choice women who said, I could never have an abortion, went on to say, but last week I thought I might be pregnant and I thought about having an abortion. So I think also you're dealing here with the difference between opinion and contextual thinking that one undergoes when one is actually in a situation faced with several alternatives demanding some kind of action. People often said they could not have an abortion, and in some cases I think that might not have been true. You know, these were people who had had abortions and maybe might consider having them again.
Hmm. We're running out of time rapidly, and we've got a caller waiting to talk with us. Let's go to that call before we have to wrap things up this afternoon. Our next caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm finding your talk really, really interesting. I have to get in your book and read it. I find the opinions about birth control interesting, and the opinions about abortion being a drain on public resources interesting. It would seem that if people were really all that accepting about birth control, that we wouldn't have as many people not using it, mm-hmm. especially teenagers when they first start having intercourse. There's clearly mixed feelings about what it means to be using birth control. I've even run across older women, adult women, who did not expect to be having intercourse and were taken by surprise. And I don't know what all was going on in their minds, but clearly we still have some deep down concerns about what it means to be organized for birth control. And when you have a major religion telling you that it's bad to use birth control, I would imagine that some people, although clearly not everybody, would have to figure out how they stood with relationship to that religion if that was theirs. The other thing I find, as I mentioned, I find interesting is this business about abortion being a financial drain. When it costs, I don't know, $400, let's say, for an abortion, and yet we're not judgmental about people who smoke and who make the decision to smoke cigarettes multiple times in a day, every day, and then the rest of us pay higher insurance rates, and we devote our doctor's time and energy to dealing with the health consequences of smoking, of overeating, of obesity. But we don't say, well, if you have a heart attack, that's your own fault.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm saying? I just find it really interesting that we are so judgmental and put such a higher weight on a woman needing an abortion than we do on somebody who makes other clear choices in their lives that are damaging to their bodies that we end up paying for.
I got to jump in here because we're out of time, but I do want to offer our guests a chance to briefly respond, comment.
Liz?
Oh, I was going to let you go first.
Yeah, I mean, I think our society is obviously very ambivalent about birth control and about the larger issue of sexual activity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's really what underlies this. Our society cannot speak frankly about sex, can certainly not speak frankly about teenage sex. And in some ways, that makes us a rather unusual society in the spectrum of world societies. You know, I think Americans are prudes. they cannot face this issue. And as a society, we pay for that.
And I think we have a tendency to hold women responsible for those decisions, too.
That's where we have to leave it. I want to thank both of you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Cole and Andrea Press are the authors of Speaking of Abortion, Television, and Authority in the Lives of Women. The book is published by the University of Chicago Press.